is for what's Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Iraq's Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi has announced the start of the long-awaited offensive to retake the northern city of Mosul, Iraq's second largest from Islamic State. In a brief statement early Monday, Mr. Abadi said the time for victory has come. He promised to soon raise the flag of triumph. The city, home to about 1 million people, fell to IS militants in June 2014. It's where IS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi declared an IS caliphate covering parts of Iraq and Syria. Turkish-backed Syrian rebels have captured the northern Syrian town of Dabiq from IS militants who earlier proclaimed it the site of a future battle between Islam and the West. Turkey's foreign minister said the next objective of the Turkish-backed Free Syrian Army is the town of Elbab. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan indicated Saturday Turkey's aim is creating a 5,000-square-kilometer safe zone clear of IS and Kurdish fighters. Syria analyst Anthony Billingsley of the University of New South Wales said the victory could also impact IS recruitment efforts.
They made such a big deal about this place at Armageddon occurring in Dabiq that the recruits that they might have been hoping to get may start to back away and say, well, wait on, you blokes aren't serious after all.
In London, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, after meeting his British counterpart Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson, took aim at the offensive by Syria and ally Russia to pound rebel-held sectors of Aleppo into submission.
It could stop tomorrow morning, tonight, if Russia and the Assad regime were to behave according to any norm or any standard of decency. But they've chosen not to.
He said new sanctions on Russia and Syria are being considered. Damascus and Moscow accused of a deadly and indiscriminate bombing campaign in the rebel-held sector. This is VOA News. The U.S., Britain, and the U.N. peace envoy to Yemen called Sunday for the warring parties in the country to immediately and unconditionally declare a ceasefire. Boris Johnson is the British Foreign Secretary.
The fatalities that we're seeing there have become, at an unacceptable level, and we've had a very good meeting today to discuss the way forward. And one of the things we think is absolutely vital is that there should be a ceasefire.
Secretary of State Kerry said an unconditional truce should lead back to the negotiating table. The two diplomats met in London with UN peace envoy Ismail Ould Sheikh Ahmed and his counterparts from the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia. A sense of new urgency to find a diplomatic solution followed an airstrike on a funeral gathering by the Saudi-led coalition in the Yemeni capital Sana'a a week ago that killed 140 people. Thousands marched Sunday in the Hungarian capital Budapest, protesting the sudden closure of the country's largest-selling opposition newspaper. The protests targeted Prime Minister Viktor Orban, who's been accused of stifling press freedom and isolating private media outlets opposed to an anti-migrant stance on refugees. The leaders of the so-called BRICS nations Sunday ended a two-day summit in India, pledging to speed economic growth and to fight terrorism. The leaders of the five countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, adopted a final declaration endorsing the commitment to act against the financing and arming of terrorist groups.
In a world of new security challenges and continuing economic uncertainties, BRICS stands as a beacon of peace, potential, and promise.
Host Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi also took aim at nuclear rival and neighbor Pakistan for being what he called the mothership of terrorism. New Delhi accuses Islamabad of sponsoring cross-border attacks, a charge Pakistan denies. The pro-Western Democratic Party of Socialists in the tiny Balkan country Montenegro unofficially won the most votes in Sunday's parliamentary election, but fell short of majority rule. It leaves Prime Minister Milo Djukanovic's government needing a coalition partner to extend his 24 years in power. The election was marred by the arrest of 20 people from Serbia suspected of planning armed attacks in the former Yugoslav Republic. Kuwait's Emir Sheikh Sabah al-Ahmad al-Sabah issued a decree Sunday dissolving the National Assembly, citing regional circumstances and security challenges. It opens the way for new elections. Government-subsidized gasoline prices in this Gulf Sheikhdom have been raised and other benefits cut, causing political dissent. Ethiopia's government issued a directive following a declaration of a state of emergency, including a dusk-to-dawn curfew around areas vital to the economy, diplomatic travel restrictions, and new police powers. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, October 17th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberia's vice president discusses why he should be the one to succeed President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf in next year's elections.
I can say to Liberia, you'll be electing an honest person, one who is committed to that country, one who has served with the experience, and a person who want now to make Liberia, think Liberia, love Liberia, and build Liberia.
That's Vice President Joseph Boakai of Liberia. Sudan's ruling SPLM party is urging members who have defected to splinter groups to return to the main party. Djibouti plays a central role in hosting thousands of Ethiopian refugees. And Malawi's president returned home yesterday, but with more questions left unanswered about the state of his health.
From the government side right now, we have not had any communication. We just heard it on the radio that the president is back. There has been communication blackout ever since he left for the United Nations General Assembly.
Kennedy Rashid is head of programs at the Malawi-based Institute for Policy Interaction. And internet monopolies could be on the way out in Africa. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberian Vice President Joseph Boakai says he should be the one to succeed President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf during 2017 elections because he is an honest person who has served the country with experience and who now wants to make Liberians to once again be proud of their country. Mr. Boakai has been vice president for 11 years now, and some critics say he must leave with President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf when her term expires next year because the government has done very little to improve the well-being of the people. The vice president is currently in the United States on what he calls a listening tour. In this exclusive interview with VOA, Mr. Boakai said Liberia has made great progress under President Sirleaf. He touted improved roads, availability of electricity, and above all, 11 years of unbroken peace that the country has enjoyed.
We are now in politics right now. The political season is not on right now, but I can say to Liberia, you'll be electing an honest person, one who is committed to that country, one who has served with the experience, with high credit rating, and a person who want now to make Liberia, think Liberia, love Liberia, and build Liberia.
Mr. Vice President, you served almost for 12 years as Vice President. I'd like for you to point to some things that this government in which you serve has done that you can be proud of.
Well, anybody who wants to be honest can look at Liberia from where we started, can look at the condition of the roads, can look at the electricity, can look at the number of students that we have encouraged to go to school and the service to the country in terms of even critical problems we have resolved, like the Ebola, that we were able to garner all the support of the international community and ourselves, our Liberians, motivate them to come on board. You look at the peace, which is the most important thing, because without peace, you can't do any of the things that we've been able to maintain, the peace of the country, to make the Liberians begin to put their lives together.
One thing that people continue to talk about is that your president, Madam Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, recognized that corruption is a problem in the country, and they feel this government in which you serve has not done much. What do you say to that criticism?
Well, corruption is a problem indeed. I am aware of that. Getting rid of corruption, I don't believe is an event. But we have been able to prosecute those corrupt officials. We have been able to institute measures to minimize that in a way to put a check system. So, indeed, we admit that corruption has been the problem that all of us have been grappling with, but this is a fact, and it is not something that we condone, and we're still working with, fighting with it.
So, Mr. Vice President, is there anything that you think could have been done better in this current government?
I always say we have a lot of reform programs. We have a lot of good programs for the Liberians. what we need to improve upon is how we make those programs work. And so all the time when you ask me, I say, yes, we do have good program, but implementation, we need to be more forceful, and that's what we need to do.
I wanted to ask, do you have the support of the president in your effort to succeed her?
Oh, yes, I do. I mean, if you listen on the radio, all over, the president has given her full endorsement, that I know.
What about the rumors that you have been considering Mr. Charles Bramskane as your vice presidential candidate?
I'm sure you said rumor, so it's still a rumor.
Is that true or not true?
It's a rumor.
Let me talk about the diaspora, why you're here. What role do you think the diaspora, the Liberian diaspora, can play?
Quite a lot, and they have been playing very well, because it is because of the diaspora, their lobbying and all of this, that we have been able to overcome some of the difficult situations we find ourselves in. The diaspora must also remain focused. If they begin to work together and see themselves as partners in what we do and remain focused, give us that support, I believe we can achieve quite a lot.
12 opposition parties signed a memorandum recently to work together. Are you considering partnering with somebody or some party, or do you think you can do it alone?
We're already working on that. And, you know, there's a belief always that when the leaders come and sign, that the followers are following. That's a separate thing to deal with. You can sign all the memorandum. You ask the voters, where do they want to go? Are you taking them along? That remains to be known.
Do you think the voters would like to go with Vice President Boakai?
It's been demonstrated already all over the country.
Mr. Vice President, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, man.
Joseph Boakai is Liberia's vice president. He was speaking with me here in Washington, D.C. Malawi President Peter Mutharika returned to his country yesterday after nearly 4 weeks of absence from the country led to speculations that he was sick in the United States. The president has been out of the country since attending last month's UN General Assembly. Malawians even launched a Bring Back Our President campaign on the social media. Information Minister Malice Ndau said in a press statement last week that the president was enjoying very good and robust health in the United States. But Kennedy Rashid, head of programs at the Malawi-based Institute for Policy Interaction, says the president's return left more questions than answers. He says, unlike in the past, Malawi television did not cover Mr. Mutharika's return. In addition, he said the president greeted the welcoming officials with his left hand instead of the usual right hand.
From the government side right now, we have not had any communication. We just heard it on the radio that the president is back. There has been communication blackout ever since he left for the United Nations General Assembly. When he came at around 3 o'clock, it was only one radio station which was at the airport, which was describing the situation which was happening at the airport. Whenever he leaves Malawi, when he comes back, he usually tells us like what he was doing outside the country. But when he came this time around, there was nothing like that. He just left. They say that the press briefing will be later on, at a later stage. But then the day has gone. There's nothing, no communication from government.
I know that the government minister of information said sometime last week that the president was enjoying good and robust health. What are Malawians saying there at home?
Malawians, most of them, they have been worried about the condition, the healthy condition of the president. On the social media, there were so many stories that had been circulating. Most of the people were saying that the president was ill and he was in the United States receiving treatment. But then the Minister of Information had to come out to clarify the situation. But when he was coming, like, for example, today from the United States, a lot of people were very anxious. They wanted to see whether the president was ill. But we have observed, of course, from the radio discussion which we were hearing, a lot of people were wondering about his movements. Basically, you know, it's a tradition that the president should shake people with the right hand, something like that. But then his right hand was not moving at all. His movements were different from the way he moves.
I was reading some comments from Malawians blaming the government for this misinformation. Let's assume that the president is not sick. It's up to the government to continue to inform the people.
Yes, the government, this time around, it has been a very strange trip for the president when he went outside Malawi, for example, to the United Nations General Assembly. Because basically, when he goes out of Malawi, the state broadcaster, which is NBC, they always update Malawians what the president is doing each and every day, the meetings that he has been having. But then soon after the General Assembly, there was a blackout, no communication from, no any programs from the state broadcaster, nothing at all. We were just being informed that the president is still engaging with other issues. The president is still doing other government businesses. So people were still wondering, like, okay, what is going on? Where is our president? That's why they initiated that campaign on the social media where they were bringing this idea of bring back our president, like the Chiboko Girls campaign. People are very anxious. We were expecting them to communicate to us. It is the responsibility of the Ministry of Information to update Malawians every movement and every activity that the president is having outside this nation. Because the president, before being him as a human being, right now, we do respect his privacy, but then he's also our head of state. So we always want to know where is our head of state.
Now, you mentioned that only one radio station was doing the commentary about the president's arrival. Was there any television coverage? And is this unusual that there was only one radio station covering the president's arrival?
Yes, this is very unusual trip, as you're saying, because most of the times there are programs, live coverage of the president's arrival. They call them presidential diaries. We usually see the president arriving. There's usually a press briefing, something like that. The public broadcaster was not even broadcasting anything of that nature. It was this private radio station called Zodiac, which was covering the situation which was on the ground, which was very unusual.
Kennedy Rashid is head of programs at the Malawi-based Institute for Policy Interaction. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lilongwe. Today is Monday, October 17th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton, Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's send shout-out to listeners on our affiliate station, Capital FM in Blantyre, Malawi. Daybreak Africa time is 18 minutes past the hour. The ruling Sudan People's Liberation Movement, SPLM, has urged party members who have joined splinter groups to return to the main party and prepare for the 2018 presidential election. SPLM Deputy Secretary for Information, Deng Madeng, says the 2018 elections are an opportunity for politicians to contest for elected positions across the country. Tito Justin reports from Juba.
Deng Mading says the SPLM ruling party is a democratic party which gives opportunity for every South Sudanese to contribute his or her ideas. Mading says the SPLM is a revolutionary party that is being threatened by opposition politicians in the government of national unity.
There is no way this country will be surrendering itself to dark forces. It is only through democracy where we have a peaceful transition of power from a generation to a generation. There is no way that we can do it through the bullet of the guns. It will be through the ballot box, through the Southern Sudan people votes. So we need to respect our voters.
Mading says members of the SPLM in Juba still believe in good governance, democracy, accountability, and the rule of law. He says all members of the party who are against the Kiir administration are welcome to contribute ideas and reform the party, a right that is protected under a previous agreement.
We have already Arusha. So the FDs and the SPLM IO are covered in the Arusha agreement. Because in that Arusha agreement, the SPLM, wherever they are united under the Arusha agreement. And that Arusha agreement, we have put it in the it is incorporated in the constitution of the SPLM. Therefore, whether they like it or not, they are covered by the Arusha agreement and they are SPLM.
He says the 2018 proposed elections is an opportunity for South Sudanese to elect leaders through the ballot, not by force.
If the SPLM is a majority in the parliament, then they will have a right now to form the government, not the government of national unity. It will be the government of the people, elected by the people and for the people and by the people. So that is what is going to happen. 2018 is going to fix the whole problem of SPLM.
The SPLM was formed in 1983 and the party waged war for 22 years against the Khartoum-based government. Factions of the party split into the SPLM in opposition and the SPLM former detainees after fighting broke out in late 2013. A fragile peace agreement signed by the warring parties in 2015 proposed general elections in 2018 that would lead to the peaceful transition of power in the country. However, the future of 2018 general elections in the country is unclear because of reports of ongoing fighting across the country. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
The International Organization for Migration, or IOM, has warned that a migration refugee crisis unfolding in Yemen and Djibouti is having a serious impact across the Horn of Africa. Lisa Schlein reports from the IOM headquarters in Geneva.
The International Organization for Migration says about 10,000 migrants, mostly from Ethiopia, make the long, dangerous trek across the blistering hot desert to Djibouti every month. From there, they transit through war-torn Yemen to Saudi Arabia in search of work. The IOM says most of the migrants are young men. About 30% are unaccompanied minors, some as young as 11. It says very few women are to be seen. Jeffrey Labovitz is IOM director for Eastern Horn of Africa. Speaking by telephone from Obok, Djibouti, he says the women are largely invisible because smugglers take them to Saudi Arabia by car to work as domestic servants.
And it's much more clandestine and organized, and so we're not seeing them. But it also means in terms of protection, you don't know what's going on at all.
Labovitz says Yemen recently has begun deporting Ethiopian migrants to Djibouti. He says it appears thousands are likely to be deported in the near future. He calls it a very worrying prospect for a small country like Djibouti.
What we're seeing right now, too, in Yemen is that in the government areas, they're asking us to urgently provide food and services to over 4,000 individuals in detention. And we also hear in the coalition areas that there's several thousand who may be deported soon. We don't know.
Labovitz says the IOM will not be able to handle such a huge surge of migrants. He says the Migration Response Center, the transit center run by the IOM and the Ministry of Interior in Obok, can take care of about 100 migrants at one time. Currently, he says, the center is hosting between 600 and 700 stranded Ethiopian migrants. He says Djibouti could soon be facing a massive surge of migrants, creating a humanitarian crisis. To make matters worse, he says the IOM's voluntary return program is largely on hold because most of the Ethiopian migrants have no documents and the IOM is strapped for cash. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This month, workers in the telecommunications sector in Burkina Faso were on strike again, leading to phone and internet interruptions. The country only has one internet service provider, but as Bram Postman's reports from Ouagadougou, the days of the telecoms monopoly in Africa may be coming to an end.
$5 billion CFA francs, that's $8.5 million. The telecom authority in Burkina Faso slapped this fine on Onatel, the country's single internet service provider, or ISP. The fine was a response to the lengthy strike at Onatel, which cut internet access across the country for more than a week. Failure to provide, said the authority. You pay. To get an idea of how bad things were, I got in touch with Aruna Wedrago, an IT specialist.
Comprenez qu'il y a des hommes d'affaires qui ne peuvent pas faire deux heures sans Internet. si se retrouve coupé de l'internet pendant.
He had business people rushing to his internet cafe with contracts to sign, documents to send, last resort. But he couldn't help them. People outside this country just cannot imagine that there is no internet, he says, let alone for a week. He knows people so desperate they flew to Bamako in neighboring Mali just to get their emails. The problem? Onatel is a monopoly, as the political researcher Thomas Ouedraogo explains.
On était coupé des différents contacts et on n'a pas pu réaliser. Il y a eu énormément de pertes.
This whole country got cut off from the world because one company has management problems and relates badly to its workers. This cannot continue. What's to be done? Break it up. Open the market, he says. Burkina Faso is among a fistful of African countries that has to make do with just one or two ISPs like Onatel. Two bad things happen as a result, says IT specialist Aruna Ouedraogo.
C'est trop cher l'internet au Burkina, c'est trop cher, il faut dire. Et ce qui, en plus de c'est pas trop cher, le débit n'est pas ça, parce que dans les sous-régions, nous sommes un peu...
We pay too much for our internet connections, he says, and we get very little capacity. His solution? Bring in the competition. And it's happening. A French company is laying its own fiber optic cable. Soon, Aruna hopes, Burkina Faso's internet agony will be over. Bring in more players, bring down the price, and you'll become Nigeria, or Mauritius, or indeed Kenya, the continent's star performer. The website Internet World Statistics says that 70% of Kenyans have an internet connection, usually with their smartphones. 20 African nations lag behind, with less than 10% access. They're either landlocked, have poor infrastructure, or a single ISP. As a result, the Central African Republic, Niger, Malawi, Burkina Faso and others have a tiny customer base. Only big institutions, rich elites and expats can afford a connection. But this business model is losing ground. The reason? Massively increased internet capacity, bringing down the price of a connection even in remote areas. 6 years ago, only 2 undersea fiber optic cables went to an African shore. Now, it's more than 10. Internet usage has tripled in the last 5 years, says the African Bureau of the Internet Society. So the message to the last remaining Onatels on the continent is twofold. One, get used to competition. Two, start responding to consumer demand. Together, they will make or break your business. Bram Posthumus for VOA News, Ouagadougou.
And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. A group of Nigerian parents was reunited Sunday with 21 schoolgirls kidnapped by militants more than 2 years ago. Nearly 300 girls were taken from their school in 2014 in Chibok in northeastern Borno State, where Boko Haram has waged a 7-year insurgency aimed at creating an Islamic state, killing thousands and displacing more than 2 million people. Last week, the rebels released 21 girls in the first negotiated release brokered by the International Red Cross and the Swiss government. The girls were released Thursday and flown to Abuja, Nigeria's capital, but it took days for the parents to arrive from their remote region. And that's it for this Monday, October 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Barton in Washington saying, have a productive week.
Next on Let's Talk, we will talk about marriage. When is the right time to get married? What are the ingredients necessary to make marriage a successful, lasting partnership? Join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing marriage. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we look at the role of the Darfur Women Action Group in Western Sudan. We'll discuss what key issues the organization is tackling in Darfur. That's next on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.